South Florida finally gets its soccer team, just not in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Inter Miami is set to kick off its inaugural season next year, but not in Miami. They're going to be playing at a site where Lockhart Stadium used to be. It's only supposed to be there for 2 years until the permanent space is built in Miami. We'll talk with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis about having soccer in the community and if they're ready to keep the team for longer, just in case. Also, have you been to a food hall? How would you describe the experience? Food halls are popping up all over the region. Some are growing, some have come and gone. Do they have staying power? And Cuban Nostalgia is a 3-day event that tries to recreate the historic places and experiences of old Cuba. And we'll get a preview. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, starting next spring, South Florida will finally have Major League Soccer. Inter Miami will begin play years after David Beckham promised to bring soccer to the area. But of course, the first couple of years, the team's existence will not be in Miami. It's going to be in Broward County at what used to be Lockhart Stadium. Remember that? That's the place the old MLS team, Miami Fusion, played. The deal for Inter Miami is to buy the golf course here near MIA. That hasn't finalized yet. We're joined now by Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis. He joins us now. Mayor Trantalis, thank you so much for your time today.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so you're going to have a Major League Soccer team for at least a couple of years at what used to be Lockhart. They're knocking it down. They're going to put up a new stadium. You've had different events at that stadium for a number of years now, but now you're going to have a committed team. What do you hope that brings to the area?
Well, first of all, we appreciate your bringing attention to what is happening here in the city. It's an exciting time for the city, and when the opportunity presented itself, the commission and the city manager were eager to work with the David Beckham Group, with the Moss brothers, because we realized a deal could be made here to benefit everybody, not just the team, but more importantly, the aspects of it that are going to include the community, the schools, the academy that they're going to build here for budding soccer players. It's a great opportunity for the community. So to that extent, the city thought it would be wonderful to you know, sit down and talk with these folks. And together we struck a deal where not only are they going to rebuild Lockhart Stadium, but they are also going to add additional play fields for football, for soccer, for the local community, which is really an important part of, you know, the purpose of public land, which is to make sure it stays open for the public.
Now, you know, this area, you have some communities. You have the Executive Airport nearby. You have industrial parks. How is having that soccer team going to boost the region? What do you see?
Well, we feel that we're not quite sure how many years the soccer team, the MLS team, is going to be here, but we do know that they're going to bring a minor league team to the area, and they're going to keep it there permanently. So that was part of the agreement. So whether it be the MLS team or the minor team, there will be continuous play here at the new Lockhart Stadium. But keep in mind that the economic impact is going to be significant because not only is the team going to be playing there, but also their facilities, their academy, their sports facilities, some of their administration. It's going to be an ongoing 12-month operation there. I've already spoken to investors who are looking to look for sites right now to build a hotel, at least one hotel. It will foster a good deal of interest in the sport as well as in Lockhart Stadium as a venue for continuous use.
And you said something interesting just now. You don't know how long they're going to play there. They say 2 years, but they're still trying to figure out the deal in Miami, and then we don't even know if that's going to happen. I mean, look, you may have a team for a long time, and that may be good for you.
Well, we only want the best for the team, but at the same time, the team only plays a certain number of days out of the year. What really is going to be impactful to the community is the community aspect of it, keeping the playing fields open for local groups, local soccer clubs, as well as the high schools and other intramural sports activities that can take place on these grounds, in addition to the major minor league sports activities.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, I mean, you have, look, Lockhart Stadium being torn down, so is the baseball field. And look, there's a lot of history, especially with that baseball field, because that was, you know, the New York Yankees training spring training facility for a long time. How do you feel about tearing down that history, and how do you try to even protect any of it?
Well, no one wants to tear down history because a community really needs its history and its past to be able to build upon for the future. I'm a big believer in that. But if you go to those places, you know, the city has completely abandoned those sites. They're dilapidated. They're unsafe. And it would certainly take a lot of money and time to think we could rehabilitate it. And we're not quite sure what we could ultimately use it for. The spring training teams have long since left Fort Lauderdale for whatever reason. I think we've missed out on opportunities over the years that we should have taken advantage of. But we are where we are today. And the best thing for the city right now has been to make a deal with the Inter-Miami Beckham Group. And I really feel that that will have the best and most productive impact for our community.
I'm talking with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trentalis. Again, Inter-Miami, the MLS team led by the David Beckham Group, is going to be starting its inaugural season is next year. And they're going to be playing at what used to be Lockhart Stadium. They're tearing it down, putting up a new one. That's supposed to be temporary because they're trying to work their deal to be in Miami. So we'll see how long they're going to be in Fort Lauderdale. I wanted to move over to something else real quickly before I let you go, Mayor.
Sure.
This is an issue that's coming up for vote in July. This is about increasing salaries and benefits for city commissioners and for you, for the mayor. Basically doubling the salaries. I mean, right now, commissioners are making $30,000 a year. The mayor's making $35,000. You know what? Is it about making this a full-time job for people? Because I know you're not living on that salary, but is it important to have our politicians on a full-time job?
Well, I think I wouldn't phrase it that way. The way we look at it is in order for us to recognize the fact that being in public service, being on the city commission and the mayor's office has become more of a full-time undertaking. You know, Fort Lauderdale is no longer the sleepy seaside town it may have once been, for better or for worse. I know some people don't like that anymore, but considering the decisions that have been made in the past, the city is now undergoing a significant transformation, and we're becoming more of a metropolitan area than we are just a small Fort Lauderdale, like I said, seaside town. For that reason, many of the responsibilities have increased significantly for people who serve on this commission, especially the mayor's office. And whoever serves in these positions in the future has got to be committed to understanding that this can be a full-time undertaking. In order for people to be attracted to these roles, we have to make sure that we compensate people so that they can afford to run for these positions. Otherwise, city government is only for the rich, the retired, people who may have a second income in their household. It can't be for primary breadwinners. And we certainly shortchange ourselves if we limit the pool of candidates to such a narrow group that, you know, Fort Lauderdale will never be able to draw from the great talent that it has within its city
and,
by limiting the salaries that we now have.
And
now, keep in mind, salaries have not been raised for once these go into effect, it would be almost 20 years.
Right, right.
So you say it's a big jump, but they haven't been touched in 20 years. So, and even when they were, it was back in 2002 where the salaries were raised by 100% from the previous level.
Even though you're doubling them, I mean, those positions, will they still have to have a second job, or are you expecting them to put all their focus on this?
We would hope that people would not need to have second jobs. The idea is to put a payment compensation program together that would be consistent with what the median family income is for Broward County. That's how it's being rated.
And just a note too, this wouldn't go into effect until after the November elections of 2020. Do you think it's going to work this time? Do you think it'll go through?
I think there's a consistent opinion on the commission this time because everybody realizes how important it is to focus our efforts more full time than it has in the past. It's been a struggle. I've seen other commissioners. I've been on this commission for quite a few years, and I've seen how a struggle it is for some of these commissioners to be able to maintain their households and still be able to have be in public office. There was an attorney a number of years ago who actually quit in the middle of his term because he said he couldn't handle the job as well as his practice. So, this is very real. And the reason why it's important to me is because I want to see great talent coming to the commission. We have great talent there now. I wanted them to be able to stay on the commission. I want, us to be able to continue to draw additional talent in years ahead that will continue to make Fort Lauderdale the best city in Florida. And we're on our way to becoming that. And I'm very proud that of this commission and what we've been able to do so far.
Again, that vote coming up in July. We've been talking with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis. Mayor Trantalis, thanks so much. I know you're busy today.
Okay, thank you. Happy to be part of it.
All right. And again, as we were talking about, originally it was the Inter Miami, the Major League Soccer team led by the David Beckham Group. They are going to start playing next year, but they're going to be playing in Fort Lauderdale where the Lockhart Stadium used to be. They're building a new one there. They say it's temporary because they're trying to finalize their deal here in Miami to be Inter Miami. You've been waiting. You're a fan. You've been waiting for a while. Find us on social media, WLRN Sundial. I want to know your thoughts. How do you feel about waiting for your team? Are you going to make that trek up to Fort Lauderdale to watch the team for a couple years? We'd love to hear your thoughts again at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, have you made it to any of South Florida's food halls? What do you make of them? We have a panel discussion about this latest food trend coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, food halls have become the latest trend in South Florida, with almost a dozen popping up around the region over the last couple of years. The latest was Time Out Market in Miami Beach, and within the next couple of months, Sistrunk Market is expected to open in Fort Lauderdale. Now, the concept is simple: a large public space with multiple food vendors to choose from. Like a food court in a mall, right? Okay, I'll ask that question. Maybe not. Today we're having a panel discussion about food halls. What makes them unique? What do you have to do to make them successful? Are they sustainable? Joining me now in studio is Nick Heyman. He's the owner of the Citadel in the Little Haiti Little River neighborhood, which opened just a few months ago. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us in studio is Zachary Fagenson. He's the food writer for the Miami New Times and for Reuters. Zachary, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
And joining us from WXEL in Boynton Beach is Chris Villa. He and his wife, Kristen Schoenwald Villa, are behind the Grandview Public Market in West Palm Beach. Chris, thank you for being here. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And again, we want to hear from you as well. What has been your food hall experience? You can tweet us or find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Tell us what you think about them. Tell us about your experiences. We'd love to hear it. All right, let me start with this, because I've had this conversation with people here at work. I'm going to play the role of the cynical Gen Xer. Tell me what a food hall is, Nick. Tell me why it's not a food court.
I think the major differentiator, at least for us, there's two. One of them is definitely the sense of experience that you get when you walk into the space. And the term food hall, at least for me, and the way we've always envisioned it, always denotes a sense of community, right? So you're sitting down, you're having a conversation with people that you may or may not have met before, and you're doing it over, amazing, in our case, local food. So that sense of community is something that I think, at least for us at the Citadel, differentiates food hall from the term food court, I think is a little bit more basic.
Is it the food or is it the experience? It's that space.
It's both. It has to be both.
Zachary, jump in. Tell me.
I think Nick makes a good point, because I think what's going to be the case is there's so many of these popping up right now, and there's so much interest in them as we're sitting here right now, obviously shows. But I think beyond the first 6 months of an opening, what is going to happen that's going to keep drawing people back? in Miami, people love to try new things. The question I get asked a lot is, what's the new hot restaurant? And I tell people, well, these are my favorite standbys. I know I'll get a good meal. So after somebody goes the first two or three times and they've tried everything, if they don't love it, what's the reason for them to keep returning? And I think that is really something we're going to be seeing play out over a period of a year or two, perhaps.
Chris, and by the way, I apologize, Chris, I mispronounced your name. It's Vila, right?
Yes.
Thank you. My apologies about that. Chris, I want your take on that. I mean, you tell me, convince me, show me, you know, what is that food hall experience? How is it different from something else?
Well, I think what's happening nowadays in the kind of food and beverage culture is that it's very much becoming about, you know, dining as entertainment. I think that's really what people are looking for. You know, you can go to a restaurant anytime, but maybe you want to go out with a group of people and have a different experience. I think that's why there's been such a proliferation of kind of food halls, market halls. We're still searching for the term ourselves that we've seen across the country. And I think to, you know, kind of get into it a little further in terms of how do they stay relevant. I think at the end of the day, one of the toughest things that we run across is, you know, just making sure that things are staying fresh and staying new and staying exciting, because that's why people keep coming back in the door.
Chris, is it fair to say it's a trend or no?
I don't think it's a trend. I mean, I think that, you know, what happened to malls? I used to love going to malls when I was a kid, and now we're going to see, I think we'll see kind of a resurgence of those old spaces. But I think that this is definitely something that's growing. I think it's very early innings in terms of its lifespan. And, you know, I think that we have a lot of interesting situations across the country in terms of real estate and old bricks that will be kind of repurposed. So I think it's exciting.
You're almost opening up a Pandora's box. We talk about the resurgence of malls, but that's another conversation. Zachary, I mean, a trend, or is this, I mean...
Of course it's a trend.
But is this something that you think will last a long time? Or do we just change the name? Is it the branding?
I think there's an obvious difference in that a food court in a mall, what do you expect to see there? You expect to see some kind of payway or, you know, an Americanized Chinese option.
Right.
Everybody remembers the spicy chicken, the toothpicks they would hand out. You see a Sparrow's, you see something of a lower quality. I think the food halls that we're seeing now are of a higher quality. I think it is definitely a trend. We see that. I believe, you would have to double check me, that the Citadel was the first one to announce that it will be coming. And even in between the time that it opened, all of these other ones got up, they got off the ground. I mean, we're now really seeing a swell of them opening up all over the place. I think the big question is going to be, who is going to be successful and how are they going to do that? I think a big question of that is going to be the real estate. You know, as you said, Time Out just opened on Lincoln Road. That's good foot traffic. So even if people decide, who are from Miami, I don't want to keep going back, they still have foot traffic to keep bringing people in. I think in Nick's case at the Citadel, you know, I've been watching what they do. They have a lot more than just the food. There's offices on top of the building, so that's a customer base. There's a kind of vintage market on the other side of the building. If you follow them on social media, I don't mean to plug them too much, you know, they see they have exercise classes. So this is probably all done in mind to keep people coming back, because after you work out, maybe you go grab something to eat. And I think that's probably, you know, going to be a better strategy than just opening up, dishing out food, and seeing what happens.
Well, Nick is here. He can always plug himself as much as he wants to, so that's okay. But you know what, Nick? The other thing, too, is, and I come back to this idea of what you offer, what's available, and you talk about that space. Do you have to do something different in that space, offering some kind of entertainment, or it's how you lay things out that gives it, that makes it what it is?
I don't necessarily think that's the equation for everybody. For us, we certainly are providing an experience for people. So in addition to food, there's other elements of the building. For example, music. We're going to have a music performance venue down the road where you'll be able to watch a show, get something to eat, go to the bar, enjoy the retail experience as well. In part, also the food experience that you get at the Citadel is the chefs are there, right? So you interact with them and you can ask them about the food and all that, you know, kind of stuff as well. So from the customer, it feels like a very real experience. And one thing that I'll mention that I was thinking about as Zach was speaking, you know, people, they don't necessarily know what they want to eat when they come into a space, right? So what differentiates just a typical restaurant from a food hall you know, it's very easy now to just kind of show up and say, hey, let's meet, and, you know, we'll all gather as a group and we'll have 14 different things that we can eat from, right? So that format, I think, is a sustainable type of format, and I don't necessarily agree with Zach in that sense that it's just kind of a trend, right?
All right. Chris, real quickly, Grandview Public Market. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind this project for you and your wife. What do you envision?
You know, the inspiration kind of came out of nowhere for us. I mean, I'm a real estate developer. That's my background. I just have a huge interest in food. I cook five nights a week with my children and my wife, and this really just sort of landed in my lap. And we had this building, and I literally came home one day and said, hey, we're going to open a food hall. So it happened very organically. We learned a lot in the past 15 months since we've opened. I've learned a lot about operations, learned a lot about managing expectations, keeping people happy.
And this is one of the first ones, right? I mean, you didn't have much of a model to work off of.
No. I mean, we did our research. We traveled around the country. We looked at other markets, but you can only get so much from sort of the surface. You know, I think a lot of what you have to pick up in terms of the business side of things is easier said than just looking at something. But, you know, we've gotten there. And I think at the end of the day, we figured out gotten over a lot of obstacles and made a lot of people happy and delivered a lot of wonderful food.
Our producer, Alejandro Martinez, was at the Citadel yesterday talking to some folks about what they thought of food halls. She talked to Zion Mas. He is a construction worker who uses the food hall space to meet with his clients, and this is what he said about them.
There's this new phenomenon, I guess, that's happening with these food halls, and I think they're more, you know, stylistic or epicured by specific people, and so the organizations that are creating them is what's important and what makes the food halls either successful or not.
Nick, your reaction to that?
You know, I think he's dead on. At the end of the day, you know, when we started envisioning the project, it was always about having a community-centric project. And we had two pillars. One of them was food and the other one was music. We haven't fully developed the music side yet. We're getting there. But on the food side, we needed to have something that was highly curated. And it ended up being crafty and artisanal and all that sort of thing. But that adds to the experience.
Are there models that you can look at and say, because I want to get to this, what makes one successful? They're relatively young, so we don't know the longevity of these. But what I mean, is there a model you can look at and say, this would be it?
I can't really point to something right now that, you know, is similar to the Citadel. What gives me assurance that we'll be successful in the future is that we are creating a very genuine experience that so far people have gravitated to and have been very, you know, very happy with at the end of the day, and they keep coming back. We have probably about 60% of our consumer base is local, hyper-local, from just around the neighborhood, and probably 40% from down south.
Yeah.
And it is very recurrent, so
Zachary,
tells you we're doing something right.
Zachary, I mean, you've had the chance to see some of these in a lot of other different places. Can you point to this is what's going to make it successful, or... Again, maybe it just changes after a couple of years.
Things obviously change. I think one of the most successful, and I think one of the longest standing halls in the country, is Reading Terminal Market in Philadelphia, which has been there for a number of years. And that's really an interesting experience because it's been there for so long. You'll go in and you'll see Amish vendors selling donuts, selling scrapple, selling cultured butter, selling fresh produce, alongside the fried chicken and the donuts and the burger and the roast pork sandwiches, which are fantastic and a Philadelphia staple. But that's one that's in the center of the community. And it has, again, the good traffic. It has the office workers who come nearby. It has the tourists. It has the food tourists. And that seems to have a really good representation of the entire community that's there.
Again, I'm talking with Chris Vila, owner of the Grandview Public Market in West Palm Beach. Also joining me is Nick Heyman, owner of the Citadel in the Little River, Little Haiti neighborhood. And Zachary Fagenson is a food writer for the Miami New Times and Reuters. Today, again, we're talking about this growing popularity of food halls in South Florida. And I am coming at it with a little bit of a cynical point of view, but I want to know your thoughts. What do you think? Have you been to one? Tell us about your experience. What do you think about them? Have you been to others in other states, other countries? Can you compare? We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Peter Zalewski messaged us on Facebook. By the way, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. In most of the places that I have visited around the world, a food hall is a place for good local cooking at cheap prices. Miami has turned food halls into places that are effectively high-end restaurants with food court seating. Chris, I'll let you respond first.
I mean, I think that's an interesting interpretation. I think that you have to be competitive in any marketplace, and that's important because at the end of the day, you are running a business. So it's important to charge prices that are, you know, going to make sense to a wide range of people. I think, you know, as Nick was saying, and I would echo his sentiment that, you know, we are creating an experience here. You know, there are beautiful seating arrangements, places for people to hang out all day, spaces that, you know, you can just come sit in all day. So I think you're creating kind of a hub for people to just, you know, enjoy.
Zachary, you want to jump in?
I think Peter, in a sense, is spot on. I mean, I think he's talking about the hawker markets that you see in Singapore, which just have this amazing rainbow of cuisine, and the wet markets in Hong Kong, where you could go buy all this fresh seafood, have it cooked right there for you. I mean, I think these food halls, as we're sitting here with real estate developers. So they're obviously putting together a business plan. They're trying to think what's going to be most successful. And I think this is the path that they've found that's most successful. I do agree that this cuisine is a little bit expensive, considering, you know, what the reality is of what Miami can afford. We all know the statistics on the weight, on the wealth disparities that there are in Miami. So while it might seem reasonable as compared to going to a restaurant on a Saturday night, sitting down for $200, you know, I don't know if the vast swath of Miami, all those people west of I-95 essentially, are really going to see it the same way.
And there have been criticisms on social media about, you know, the price points. We talk about food halls. Nick and Chris, I want to hear from you as well. Mm-hmm. Nick, I mean, you know, this question of who are you catering to? I mean, the locals, but is it more of an affluent clientele?
You know, our location is just south of Miami Shores, but it's also in the Little River neighborhood of Little Haiti.
Are you attracting people from the community?
And I encourage anybody to go to the Citadel and see, you know, the types of people that go there, because it's very wide ranging, whether it's social, you know, economic or not. Our price points are actually very reasonable. You know, we're probably between $12 and $16, you know, in and out for lunch. So,
Chris, I want your take on that too. I mean,
I think it's also important to mention that at the end of the day, there is a lot of activity going on back of house to make these things run. So you've got porters going in and out. You've got music being played. You know, that's all on us. And I think that we also are surrounded by people from all different socioeconomic levels. And I think we see them there every day, having lunch, having dinner, sitting next to each other at a picnic table out in the loading dock, tucking into a plate of ribs or a burger or a salad. I mean, so you got everybody there. And I think we try to appeal to everybody. At the end of the day, these vendors are all behind the counter. The owner is there behind the counter, you know, serving food, and there's a lot of things happening, but I think we're pretty fairly priced.
Nick, I wanted to come back to you on this. The Citadel, it is in a very unique market. You're in the Little River, Little Haiti neighborhood. Why did you choose that location?
You know, initially, I really just fell in love with a couple of just area dynamics, right? Like, one was we're surrounded by rooftops. It's in an existing historic neighborhood. And also just from a real estate fundamental standpoint, like, you know, we have access to, you know, nice corridors and things like that. So, you know, when we started investing in that neighborhood in 2014, you know, I think that we had a lot of the right, you know, framework to embrace the community and really enhance, you know, certain components of food culture there.
And who are some of the restaurants that you partnered with?
Well, we have 14 different ones. I don't want to single anybody out.
Okay,
but,
I understand.
But I can go through all of them.
Well, did you go looking for them, or is it just...
Yeah, every single one that we have there, we sought after, and, you know, we got to a place where we felt comfortable with one another and made it happen.
And these, by the way, are these restaurants, they have existing brick and mortar locations.
Most of them have secondary or, you know, tertiary locations.
And this comes back to you were saying at the very beginning, which is what you're offering, which is it has to be unique. It's not like, as Zachary said, it's not you're getting your Sbarro and your, you know, your what's the Panda one?
Panda Express.
Okay. So you're offering the local cuisine, something that's correct. Unique to the area, right?
Absolutely. All these guys, I would say 95% are local or are identify themselves as local operators. So, you know, whether you have, you know, meat and cheese with a charcuterie or, you know, Antonio Bouchard's concept or, you know, Vice City Bean, who, you know, has another local right. you know, coffee establishment. I mean, these guys understand the market. They know how to produce in this market and how to deliver good product to the consumer base.
Zachary?
I think there's also an important distinction to sort of keep in mind. I mean, we're here kind of grilling Nick as a real estate developer, but there's really kind of two lanes. There's the developers, and then there's also the cooks and the chefs and the restaurants themselves. And I mean, the restaurant business is a tough business. It's low margin.
Yeah, most don't last that long.
It's high turnover. Most of them don't last that long. So I think these are particularly attractive to a lot of restaurants because somebody who has a good product or even maybe even a good idea can perhaps get into a space. And I don't know what the numbers are. No one will show that to me. Apparently, all the contracts are written really well. They can get in without the same upfront investment and start getting their food to people and start building a following and start getting it out there and building their brand in a way they haven't done before. Now, I mean, those food halls are not going to be the silver bullet when we had the food truck trend that seems to have now it's on the other side of the curve. You know, that was a big kind of discussion point is are these food trucks a way for a good chef to kind of build a following and perhaps go brick and mortar one day?
Nick. Yeah, let me just kind of jump in to that point. So, you know, prior to coming into this neighborhood, I had some experience with the whole landlord-tenant typical restaurant model. And it's a very difficult model. From you know, having the right budgets to the right partners to the right menu and then finally making it successful. There's a lot of steps there, very risky steps that, you know, may or may not dictate whether that concept is going to be successful in the long run or not. What we wanted to also do with this was to create a framework where these operators can just basically step in and open the next day, right? So we took care of design and permitting and all those costs and equipment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that they don't have to deal with any of those other risk elements that are typical in the restaurant
and
business.
Chris, I don't want to leave you out on this. I mean, you're hearing all of this. Your thoughts, has that been to the sustainability of your success?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just sort of chuckling and thinking back to when we were still in demo phase and I was standing out in the loading dock eating tacos with who is our now, our Zipitios, who's our, you know, taco vendor. And I think that, you know, there is a very important kind of element of having all of these people be able to kind of take their concept, which in the past might have been into a food truck, and now take it into a brick and mortar situation where everything is laid out for them. So I think that allows a lot of small concepts that might have had a tougher time getting online, it allows them to come in and start operating right away.
And how do you measure your success? How do you measure success in this business?
In our mind, I think success is just seeing people come back and just enjoy it and just look at this location as just such a happy place where they spend time with their family and listen to music and eat food and socialize. Yeah. Seeing those same faces, you know, maybe working or having meetings and then meeting people. And I think for us, we've become this kind of wonderful hub in the middle of West Palm Beach. And I think it's nice to walk through on a Tuesday in July and see the place just packed, people sitting outside eating ramen. And so I think we kind of filled the hole that was needed.
Zachary.
Ooh, ramen outside in South Florida in July, huh?
I love doing this show right before lunch, I know.
I guess the question is, you know, I talked a little bit about the metrics for success, but these are kind of a plug-and-play format, as you said, Nick. So, you know, what happens if one stall, one vendor isn't making the grade?
Look, we certainly look at the economic side of the equation, but just as equally or more is what kind of impression and what kind of, you know, product that operator is delivering, right? So there's a lot of conversation on a daily basis to tweak to make them successful at the end of the day. Unfortunately, if it doesn't work out, then, you know, we...
But it's got to be set up where it's basically, if it doesn't, you could plug it in with something else.
Yeah, I mean, that you know, that, okay. that's easy for us. You know, we've never had to do that. You know, we're still in the early kind of startup stage, but and hopefully we never do that because we just want these guys to grow with us.
We also heard from Alex from North Miami about what she thinks food halls are doing to neighborhoods like Little Haiti. This is what she said.
It's going to be an engine of completely redistributing population, capital, whose space, like, you know, who feels comfortable and at home. If you look around this space, it's become it's a white space, and like they were gentrifying, like, it's like, oh, we have a Haitian shout out here in the corner, but it's like, where are the Haitian people enjoying the space?
Nick, there were protests by residents in Little Haiti prior to the opening of the Citadel. I'm wondering if you've had those conversations with locals about, you know, the ways in which, you know, the restaurant could be changing the dynamics of the neighborhood. What are they saying to you?
Listen, we certainly embrace the conversation. We are extremely inclusive. I think for me, the easiest thing for me to do is to tell somebody to go to the Citadel, because a lot of these, you know, criticisms come from people that sometimes haven't even attended.
Have you spoken to people in that neighborhood who have attended, they've gone to the Citadel, and now they have a different opinion, or that at least they can formulate their opinion based on an experience?
100%. I talk to people all the time. In fact, you know, tomorrow we have an event at the Citadel, which is a, you know, hyper-local, you know, Haitian event. So it's not, we are not by any means excluding any sort of group whatsoever.
Zachary.
I think in this criticism, there should also be attention paid to local government. Real estate in Miami is real estate. It's a steamroller. It rolls over things. You could see right now adjacent to the Citadel, there was one little strip mall that had a Botanica and a small cafe in it that got bought out, that got gutted, that got redone. Perpendicular to that, right across the street, is another one where the same thing is happening. So the question is where has the government been for decades, essentially, that allowed this real estate opportunity?
Nick, real quickly.
Look, and just real quick, in terms of, you know, the Citadel, that building, I mean, that building was abandoned since like 2008. So we certainly didn't reallocate, or whatever the terminology was used in that clip. We brought back to life a building that had been abandoned.
And that's part
abandoned,
of the, this is part, you know, of the debate, especially when you talk about Little Haiti, when companies come in and there's this question of gentrification. It's that word. People may not like it, but it's there. Real quickly, as we finish up, is this, because Zachary talked about food trucks, that was this big thing. They're not gone, but at the same time, as you said, maybe it's on the other side of the curb, as you put it. You know, what do you see? I'm going to go around the table. Zachary, real quickly, what do you see food halls doing over the next few years? And do you think that it's something that could fade out, or they have to evolve?
I think right now we're in the growth phase of it, right?
So early on,
we're seeing a lot of them open up, and we're seeing best practices be established. We're seeing people go out and try and figure out what they like the most.
Chris, real quickly, your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think that there are going to be a lot more of these developed around the country, and I think there are different markets for every food hall. I mean, you know, small, medium, large, and I think there's a lot of gaps that will be filled, and I think a lot of operators will get very savvy about how to do it as this grows.
Nick, your thoughts? I'll let you close it out.
I think in the right locations, some food halls will, you know, will definitely be successful, but most, I think, that don't have a certain specialty niche and that don't care about other elements, like we talked about here, experiential, et cetera, are probably going to fade out because it's easy to compete with something like that. So,
Nick Heyman is the owner of the Citadel in the Little River, Little Haiti neighborhood. We also heard from Chris Vila, owner of the Grandview Public Market in West Palm Beach. Zachary Fagenson is a food writer for the Miami New Times and freelances for Reuters. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And by the way, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know your thoughts. Which food halls have you been to? What do you love? What don't you love about them? All right. We should note one of our live from the 305 bands, Lemon City Trio, is playing at the Citadel tonight, by the way. You're listening to the new single, 16ZZ. I think I said that right. Yeah. Still to come, Cuban nostalgia coming to the Miami Fair Expo. We're going to learn more about it coming up next on Sundial.
The esa negrita que va caminando, esa negrita tiene su tumbao, y cuando la gente la va mirando, ella baila de lado también.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the Miami Fair Expo grounds will be transformed this weekend into a mini immersive Cuba experience. The event Cuba Nostalgia will recreate some of the most iconic Cuban landmarks, including the Tropicana Cabaret, the Prado Boulevard, and the Havana Cathedral. The streets will be filled with Cuban vendors and memorabilia. There will even be performances by our very own Afro-funk band, Palo. Of course, that's the band that does the theme song for this show. Joining me now, Peter Regalado. He is the executive director of the event. Peter, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
I feel good. I'm listening to that. I'm having fun. I'm ready to get going.
I love the intro.
Yeah, definitely. How do you describe the event, Cuban Nostalgia, to someone who's never been?
Well, you know, this event is going to be our 21st year now. We took it over this year, 21st anniversary. And we kind of revamped the whole event, going from a regular fair to an experience where we recreated all of these landmarks. For those who have never been to Cuba, who have Cuban parents that will never go back with the regiment that's there today, it's able to go to this event and actually visit La Bodeguita del Medio, El Paseo del Prado, not just visit pictures or just view it, but actually go in and experience the food, the drinks, the music.
One of the things, too, is that for this one, you're recreating, again, some of Cuba's most historic landmarks. You want to make it immersive, more than just, I mean, you want it to be something more sensory to everybody. How did you do it this time? What was different in year 21?
What is different today is you'll be actually able to go into the venue. You'll be able to go into the cathedral, and you'll have the pews, you know, the natural wood pews. You'll feel like you're in there. You'll be able to donate money to La Mitra de la Caridad, turn on the little candle like you do in church. I mean, these things are going to be iconic. We're going to have so many people crying coming into these venues that it's going to be crazy.
Let's talk about one of the landmarks, El Paseo del Prado. Explain the significance of that landmark, please.
This landmark, you know, it was created back in the 1900s, early 1900s. You'll be able to walk the whole Paseo del Prado, which is, we did 130 feet of it. Every time you look to each side, you'll see all of the stores that were back then in the Paseo del Prado. We recreated those same stores, of course, with vendors from today selling stuff from Cuba. You know, we have jewelry. We have a botanica in there with El Niño Prodigio doing readings. So we have all of these things that you'll be able to roll through and go back to that time.
This is very ambitious.
Very. You know, the project has cost us a little bit over $350,000 to put up. We are hoping to get that back in a couple of years. But it's something that me as a Cuban American saw that it was fading away. I have a 31-year-old daughter, not 21.
That's
anymore.
All right.
She's 31 now. I say it all the time. You know, and, you know, she knows about Cuba, but she hasn't experienced that. And, you know, she's going to go here. And besides having the actual place, outside of that, we're going to have a 55-inch TV talking about the venue, the history, what people can know about it. So it's not just going in, but I want people to actually immerse and know about the venue.
You know, that's interesting. I mean, you talk about having children who haven't had that experience. You're Cuban American. You came here when you were six, right?
Yes.
Very young. And you talk about that feeling of trying to reconnect with home. Who do you think it's going to be more special to, though? I mean, really, for people like you to remember home, or because, I mean, again, you want your kids, you want the younger generations to see something.
I think that ultimately what we want to get to is that, you know, the grandfathers and the grandmothers that are going to bring their kids and their grandkids, we want them to be there and say, look, this is what I did here, and this is why, and this is why this is so special to me. And I want it to be special to you. Like, for example, you know, some of the sponsors, we have a kitchen. We want them to be able to have chefs there that are going to teach the young generation how to do arroz con frijoles. You know, my wife doesn't know how to cook arroz con frijoles, and she's Cuban. I want her to leave that event learning how to cook arroz con frijoles.
I hope she's, you know, she's listening to this and she hears you say that.
She does. She's, you know, she's in her 30s, and she's young. She's Cuban American. She was born here. Cuban parents. I'm Cuban. And I want her to not, you know, let get away from her roots, And there's a lot there that they're going to learn about Cuba.
I'm talking with Peter Regalado. He is the executive producer of Cuba Nostalgia. It's a three-day event celebrating some of the most historic landmarks in Cuba. By the way, you can find details and photos on our Twitter and Facebook at WLRN Sundial. But again, it's this week in a three-day event that you can make something that's immersive so that you can really truly experience as much of it as possible. This is interesting, Peter, to me, is this comes back to the question of how our cultures, and I mean, I'm from Puerto Rico, but I think about, you know, the Caribbean cultures, and after we've been here for a while, you know, we start to lose that connection to where we come from. I mean, the music and the food is still there, but we're not, you know, we don't get to go back as often. And for Cubans, it's even more complicated.
For Cubans, it's even more complicated just because, you know, the obvious reasons, the political reasons. And, you know, there's so much culture in Cuba. There's so much architecture. In this event specifically, you know, all of the vendors that we have there, they're inside Cuban buildings. So you're going to be able to stand outside and look at the beauty of the architecture. We recreated La Plaza Vieja, which is one of the most iconic places in Cuba, including the fountain, which is 30 feet wide. We recreated this whole fountain. You'll be able to walk La Plaza Vieja and look at all these buildings that are so old. And if people love the architecture, they're going to love this. I mean, it's going to be amazing.
How do you tell anybody who's never been? Again, it's been around now. This is 21st year, but yes. If they haven't been, what do you advise them on the best way to really take it all in?
You know, I think the best way to take it all in is I would love and I encourage them to bring their grandfathers, to bring their grandmothers, because they're going to have a lot more input than I will. Because even though that I recreated all these landmarks, there's going to be stories that they have that are so personal to them. And they're going to come up, those stories are going to come up as they see the different venues.
And I know it's very Cuban-centric, but not, you know, anybody can go and enjoy this. It's not just for Cubans.
We would love...
There will be a lot for Cubans, but it's really...
I would love for the born American, you know, to come to the event. Why? Just like they want to go to Cuba, I want them to come here. I want them to see it. I want to experience it. I want them to learn about our history, our food, our culture, you know, and get away from them going, which is what we want.
I got you. You know what? The other thing, too, real quickly, I mean, 21 years now. Why do you think what's been the success? That's because to keep something going almost a quarter of a century is pretty impressive.
It is. You know, we took it over from Leslie Pantin, which I think did a spectacular job. But just like everything else, you know, it needs to be renovated. It needs to be brought up to the younger crowd to enjoy. Like a group like Palo will be a group, for example, that a Leslie Pantin would never bring to the event just because they don't connect with them, but we do. So we want them to come. We want the young generation to come and not only enjoy Cuba from back then, but enjoy the Cuban-American from today, which the Cuban-American from today might not know how to do arroz con frijoles. That's great. But they will learn, and we're going to push them to learn.
Oh, my goodness. Please call him, not me. I'm not the one saying that. And by the way, just to mention before we finish up here, you got a big, fat Cuban cigar in your hand.
Yes, I do.
What, you just like carrying it around? Do you want to bring a prop today?
I know. I smoke a cigar at least twice a week, believe it or not. I enjoy it. I love it. It's part of my culture. And it's just part of me. And I couldn't, one of the venues that we built was La Fabrica Partagas from Cuba, which you'll be able to go in. We're going to have experts there, cigar experts, both from cigar and from Bacardi, doing, you know, what you can smoke with, what rum, how to do it. It's going to be great.
You just got a whole bunch of people who are going to now show up just for that. Peter Regalado, again, executive producer of Cuba Nostalgia, three-day event celebrating some of the most historic landmarks in Cuba. It is going to be a really fun time. You can find details and photos on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Peter, man, thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll wait for you there.
Have a great event. And, of course, let us know if you're going. We'd love to hear your thoughts when you go. Share some of your photos on our social media. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, May 15th. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to a little Glorious Estefan right now. I'm going to step out of the way and let you enjoy that. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.